good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome in the name of the Botstieber Foundation, or rather the Botstieber Institute for Austrian American Studies. We have, over the last years, been guests here at the embassy, and we thank Ambassador Manz and his staff for that privilege. But as you already said, this year we chose a different format. It was actually the idea of our chief of the Botstieber Foundation, and I'm very happy that for that roundtable discussion I have been able to organize a number of very prominent specialists on our topic. You'll notice that intelligence has become a topic worldwide. This was not always so. As a matter of fact, until about 35 years ago, not much was known about the role of espionage in intelligence, because scientists, among them historians, didn't pay much attention to it. And there was something like an intelligence revolution in the early 80s, when all of a sudden, with good reason, historians started studying spying, possibly the oldest profession in the world. Some people think it's the second oldest. In any case, I happened to be here when the revolution took place. Just by chance, I was at the archives and I found out from an archivist that very interesting documents have just come in. Where are you from, did you say? And I didn't really think that he knew where Austria was, but I said Austria, and he said, oh, yes, but Austria. And it was the time when the CIA opened up the documents on the OSS, the wartime intelligence organization that is a forerunner of the CIA. And the next day I went there, and I haven't stopped going there for 30 years. So I'm an intelligence historian, I'm a professing intelligence historian. I even founded a center, the Austrian Center for Intelligence, Propaganda and Security Studies in Graz, to make sure that not everything is in Vienna. And we actually celebrate our 10th anniversary with a Jubilee conference in June. We also publish a journal, and we have on the internet a newsletter on intelligence that is absolutely free. And if you go on the web, www.asips.org, you can become a subscriber for free. It will not surprise you when I say that I am convinced that you can only understand intelligence issues of today and of the future if you pay attention to history, the history of spying and history of intelligence. 2 weeks ago, I attended a conference in Venice on spy chiefs in history, organized by the university. And the keynote speaker proved to us that spying was invented in Venice, of course. And he said, the Ducal Palace, that's where it all began. What he meant was spying in the sense of seeking, reading the foes and friends' mail. You get the picture, 700 years ago. Okay? So what's happening today is historically evolved, has historically evolved, and in order to understand, I think today's problems with SIGINT and the world of intelligence and the world of international relations and politics, you need to keep that in mind. And this keynote speaker proved to us that those rulers, statesmen and generals, who were intelligent here and paid attention to the other intelligence, and he meant, again, reading their mail or their communication, were the really successful people in world history. And he gave examples. And he talked about Elizabeth I, whose main advisor was an intelligencer. He talked about Tsars. He even talked about an Austrian state chancellor named Kaunitz. He talked about George Washington. After all, the Americans defeated the world power number one in that war. And he mentioned that Napoleon, although he did pay attention to the intelligence, didn't read his prose mail and communication. This is why he lost the war. Now, all of that may be disputable, but let's just take a quick look, a panoramic look at the history since. Intelligence organizations have historically been created in the last quarter or a third of the 19th century, and by the beginning of the 20th century, those powers that wanted to have some kind of influence had their organizations, as in Habsburg Austria. You know that in World War I, intelligence was already a very important ingredient, developed in great strides. Interwar years were a sort of a difficult period. Intelligence slackened a bit. In America, you had a Secretary of State who mentioned or said that gentlemen don't read each other's mail. That has changed, obviously, but World War II is obviously the major impulse to intelligence development in the 20th century, and I don't have to tell you, in the Cold War, intelligence became absolutely central. In many ways, this was an intelligence war. Both sides realized that. And as we analyze the Cold War in that respect, maybe we can come to the conclusion that because both sides knew so much about each other, that Cold War never really got hot. It certainly helped to keep it cold. Now again, after the Cold War was over, the 90s were difficult for intelligence organizations, and some of you may remember that there were even senators who wanted to abolish the CIA. In the 1990s, all of that changed. I don't have to remind you, in 2001. It has changed a little bit again about a year ago when a young American defected to China and Russia. So that's the historical background that I'd like to give. My hope for this discussion, because there are several historians on the podium, is that history will be paid attention to. But the title of our program, you've undoubtedly read, is Espionage and Intelligence in the 21st Century. How did we get here, and where do we go from here? An Austrian-American discussion. It's a dialogue. We have an international panel. There's also a Canadian on board. My claim, and I will hold back, I give lectures on intelligence in the 20th century, I will hold back because the panelists are supposed to be at the center of this, but my claim is that the 21st century may well be the century of intelligence. In any case, I tell my students intelligence is here to stay, and all the talk about no spy agreements or no spying agreements are just naive and do not look at the historical record. Okay, let me introduce the panel that we have this evening. A panel that will guarantee a broad approach, I think, and reflects special expertise. I will introduce them in the order of appearance after my introduction. Timothy Naftali You see.
Wow.
Turn the lights on.
An old friend of mine is well known for his expertise in intelligence, counterintelligence, specialist on OSS, specialist on many things. He is the director at the moment of the Temperament Library in Robert F. Wagner Archives of New York University. He has taught at many universities before, and remarkably, he was until not too long ago the director of the Nixon Presidential Library and Museum in Dover, Linda. I've known Tim since 1988, and I'm really glad that he took the time to come. Jim Carafano, next to him, yes, well known to some of you, or maybe most of you, from television. He's a historian by training. He wrote a book on military intelligence in Austria after World War II. Has a number of jobs, vice president for defense policy studies, E.W. Richardson Fellow, and director of the Catherine and Shelby Harlan Davis Institute of International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Then I will ask Audrey Chris Cronin, a professor in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University, also a specialist in Austria, because she wrote a dissertation on Austria. And she's also remarkably an associate, a research associate at Oxford University in England, a specialist on terrorism. Then John Irvin, on the left. John is a former intelligence officer and current chairman of an organization called NOIR of Ford USA, an organization whose mission it is to educate and promote the concepts of NOIR and ideas to improve US national security by fixing the problem of inside spies. You existed a year ago, and the concepts had not yet matured. And last, I invited my Austrian colleague from the University of New Orleans, Günter Bischoff, who was here a couple of days ago in the book presentation, who is a specialist on international relations, not necessarily on intelligence issues, but I wanted a generalist among us to rein us in if we take off on tangents. And Günther is certainly somebody who can do that. Let me just quickly tell you the format that I envisioned. We will have each member of the panel bring up the issues that she or he thinks are crucial in a 5-minute statement. Then in the second round, the panelists will have the chance to respond to some of the statements other panelists made in only 3-minute portions. And then we'll go to the audience, and we have certainly 20 minutes or more for you to make statements, questions, and interact with the panelists. And then at the end, we'll give everyone a chance in the final statement of 1 minute. We must finish by 7:45, and I think we will be able to do that. So let me start, as I indicated, with Dr. Naftali. Let me just place a question. You can respond to it in the beginning or at the end. Tim is a specialist of intelligence generally, as much as counterintelligence. What would you say are the ingredients, the elements of intelligence that a global citizen be it from a small country like Austria or from the United States, the hegemonic country in the world, needs to know today in order to be able to understand intelligence needs in the 21st century. Tim, please.
Would you like to come here?
No, we can go. But I like going there.
Well, if you like going there,
I prefer it.
First of all, there is always a question when you're asked a question. Do you answer it? Do you dodge it? It's a great question, and I promise I'll get to it. As Siegfried mentioned, I've known him a long time. I've also known Gunther Bischoff a long time. They introduced me to Austria and to Austrian intelligence, and I don't just mean the organizational type, and it's been a pleasure. Siegfried and I were doing this in the late 80s when some of the people from World War II were still alive, and we actually did some interviews together, some pretty famous and interesting people, and I have great memories and learned a lot from it. But today, we talk about something else for a moment. German, Brazilian, Australian, Austrian, and American audiences have recently been dazzled by revelations offered up by the increasingly mysterious man-child, Edward Snowden, who I believe is the first self-described secret agent ever to have been granted asylum in Russia without cooperating with the Kremlin's intelligence community. In a sense, he's a little Harry Potter-like, but I'm teaching again, so for some of you, this particular reference may make no sense at all, but for others it might. It's unclear whether he chose what the sorting hat chose for him, which would have been to go to Slytherin and would have put him on the dark side, or he decided to go to Gryffindor and just become the nice Harry Potter. Now, regardless of which Harry Potter Edward Snowden turns out to be, I think a discussion of the future of intelligence and the implications of the Snowden revelations should start with a little bit of historical background, which is, I think, why Siegfried asked me to come. So I'd like to start with two different quotations that might help contextualize the effects and issues of the Snowden revelations. First, regarding the issue of privacy. Quote, "It is an undoubted fact that the dossier, or file, is frequently asked for by arrivals at high political position, and the police, of course, make a pretense of surrendering it. But do not think for a moment that they actually surrender each and all documentary proofs and tidbits of private intelligence which have come into their possession regarding the person most concerned. The great man is, of course, given a dossier of sorts. Yet a year or so later, when the politician has fallen from his high office, the pedigree is replaced in the police archives, often fatter and more succulent than ever." This was written in 1915, and it was a description of the French ability to acquire private information on people for the use of blackmail, but for the purposes that the Austrian ambassador was alluding to. But it was also about the knowledge in 1915, nearly 100 years ago, that states acquire information about one's self. The other is about the desire for total information, for everything. Quote, "The spy's great moment of danger comes not when he is spying, but when he undertakes to transmit whatever information he has been able to secure. 9 out of every 10 who are detected by counter-espionage agents have faulty communications to blame for their arrest and court-martial. And in consequence, a great deal of cleverness and imagination has been put to work upon the spy's problems of transmitting intelligence, with results ingenious and novel, and sometimes absurd and fantastic." That was written by Richard Rowan in 1929. So the theoretical basis for the intelligence folder prism, described by Snowden's famous PowerPoint, is much older than his grandparents. It is the acquisition of information by the state about its citizens. I do not know what happened to the police archives or dossiers of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but I suspect the French police haven't thrown much away. That is, whatever wasn't stolen by the Germans and then stolen from them by the Soviets during World War II. So the concept of the dossier, the file, is as old as the first paperclip. the first paper cut. So now it's digital. But the notion of information collected about a person is not new at all. The other theory and foundation of, or the understanding of intelligence that is relevant today is that of the control over communications. I agree with Siegfried that the 21st century could very well be the center of intelligence, because in some way we're returning back to the way it was in World War II. To make a long story short, World War II was an unusual period in the history of intelligence. It was the period of total information awareness, to use the term that Admiral Poindexter revived after 9/11. It was that because of a fluke. Two very important things happened. One, the center of international espionage for a moment was Great Britain. Britain is an island country, as we all know. The Brits had determined and discovered a way to control an empire from an island. And because they were and are islanders, they had a sense that they could actually control all the channels of communication. When the United States came into the espionage war of World War II, the British were their tutors. And what they taught them was that you can acquire total information awareness of your enemy if you control channels of information. And the British had very astutely done that over centuries. As technology changed, the British learned how to tap into various sources of information. Take a look, for example, at the map of all interoceanic telecommunications in that era, all the cables. They always came up either in a British colony or in a country like Portugal that was very close to Britain. Thus, the British were able to tap every interoceanic cable in the interwar period. The British also told the Americans about how to control air traffic. The British bribed or acquired, through their subsidiaries, all of the manifests of every airplane, every plane trip taken in at least areas that they controlled. The British intercepted all mail in areas they controlled. In that era, planes, airmail, went on planes, and planes couldn't fly, with the exception of Charles Lindbergh, they couldn't fly from the United States to France or Great Britain without stopping. If you look at where those planes stopped, if you wanted to go from the United States to Brazil, if you wanted to go from the United States to Europe, if you wanted to go to the United States to Africa, you had to stop in British colonies. And when you stopped in a British colony, they never told you how long the plane would take to leave, because they had to open the luggage compartment, pull out all the mail, including the diplomatic bags, open them, make copies, reseal, put it away, and fly on. The British taught the United States how to do this, and we started doing it. Our desire to tap every line of communication started in 1943 and never stopped. It should not be a surprise that we do this. It's part of what you do when you're a great power. So the theories that underlay the Snowden revelations are not new. What is new is the technology. And that is something we'll have to talk about in the Q&A. But it's the technology that allows the United States to get better control over these channels of information than anyone has had since the British in World War II, which means we may be back to 1943 again, which will allow for all kinds of intelligence coups and opportunities that were not possible in the Cold War. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I came totally unprepared for pop culture references. So I'm just scrambling here. So what do I have to offer? So I once did a panel on 24, and Kiefer Sutherland couldn't make it, so I actually filled in for Kiefer Sutherland. And I once testified with Ben Affleck in before Congress, and Ben Affleck played a spy. So that's all I have. I'm a historian by training. What I want to do is take my historian hat off, put on my political hat, because I've been at Heritage for almost a dozen years now, and I've been both an eyewitness and participant to the debate over the intelligence and the belly of the beast. So I want to talk about the politics of the intelligence debate, but I want to talk about it from the perspective of somebody as a political observer, said, what will historians really key on? And when they write this chapter of history, what will be the turning points? And I would just just list four of those very quickly and then suggest where it's going to take us in the future. So I'll be really fast. So we come back, of course, the central debate is over the Patriot Act. And the trope for this debate is what's commonly called lawfare, which is, look, we don't like the policy, right? But it's post 9/11 and everybody wants us to fight terror, so we can't argue the policy. So what we have to do is we have to take the policy and convert it into a legal debate. That it's, what you're doing is, it's not that I don't like the Patriot Act, it's that it's unconstitutional, illegal. So it's reframing a political debate as a legal struggle. Well, of course, the problem with that is it's not a real debate. It's an artificial debate, which is designed by nature to be polarizing and therefore can't be solved. So we go through the period of the acceptance of this Patriot Act, this very, very polarizing, angry debate between two sides. Just a really quick vignette. I'm on this radio debate. I'm debating a woman in England. I don't want to tell you where she's from. I'll just tell the initials, ACLU. And we're doing a call-in show in Africa, and this guy calls in from Nigeria. And he says, what's happened in America is that America has just abolished this constitution and replaced it with the Patriot Act. And the woman in England said, yes, you're right. I mean, I can say a lot of things about the Patriot Act, but it abolished the constitution, but basically you're telling everybody in Africa that. All right. So that debate was predictable that in the end they're not going to stop the Patriot Act, but that is key because that was the trope for how you debate intelligence reform, and that was locked in. And the second key point really is the Intelligence Reform Act of 2004, which really, in a sense, put everybody to sleep, right? That was the typical congressional sleeping pill. We're going to write a law, it's going to solve all the problems, and then we're going to move on to another problem, right? And so they did that, and in a sense, it was the bookend or the end of the debate. Because there wasn't anything really to argue about anymore. You know, interestingly enough, if that had happened just slightly later, say once Iraq had really melted down and there were no WMD, and that in a sense became the core of the political debate, and then post-Katrina when the administration lost an enormous amount of legitimacy, I don't think that law would have ever passed, and that debate might have never ever ended. But the law got did before the administration really got into major political trouble. And the intelligence issue really kind of goes underground. But two very important things come out of the reforms which culminate in 2004 Act, which almost predetermined that we were going to have another crisis. One of them was the notion that we had to know everything. As a matter of fact, we didn't know what we needed to know, so you needed to tell us, we needed to find out everything we could because we didn't know what was important and we couldn't afford to miss anything. And the other thing is we had to share all this information with everybody. We go from need to know, from demand to share. That means you're going to have, at some point, a massive intelligence failure. Because if you're collecting everything on everybody, and you're sharing it with everybody, sooner or later, somebody's going to take that information, and they're going to put it on the internet. And what was shocking to me was not that the Manning thing was such a big surprise to everybody, but that after the Manning thing, the Snowden thing was an enormous surprise, because this was a total predictable crisis. What was also completely and utterly predictable was that the framework for the debate was going to lapse exactly back to the tropes of 2001 and 2002, and we were going to have this Manichaean dialogue between evil and good, constitutional and unconstitutional, and we weren't going to have a reasonable debate or analysis of how to do that. And so we essentially repeated this unwinnable debate. Now, and what's the result of that? The result of that is essentially we have an administration which actually would like to argue against itself on both sides of the debate. And what they've essentially done is, it's done that. So on the one hand, there's this recognition and this that we're not going to walk away from we need to know everything and we need to share everything. We're going to continue to do that. But also on the other hand, that this is horrible, terrible, illegal, unlawful, ghastly, we shouldn't do this, we're not going to do that. And the way we're going to square the circle, and the way we square the circle is we're going to do maybe some reforms which will add a lot of friction and some confusion and some inefficiencies to the system, but in the end of the day won't stop us from doing the fundamental post 9/11 revolution intelligence reform that we've done. We're just going to do it a lot less inefficiently, and we're okay with that because it gives us sufficient political cover. But here's the problem is we're doing it in an age of declining financial resources. So you can have a lot of friction when you have a lot of money and a lot of people, but when things get tight, a lot of friction is actually going to put you in a crisis mode. And whether it's hiring the lowest, you know, big contractor that hires the Snowden, or beginning the Ukraine crisis with the Defense Intelligence Agency having exactly no one on the intelligence desk for the Ukraine when the crisis broke, after knowing that this was something that's rolling for 3 years. So what I predict is we're going to enter a phase of bubbling through, which will culminate with the next great intelligence failure, which will predictably happen in the next couple of years. Then we will try to come up with an intelligence problem and solve it again. But having locked in the trope that the way you debate intelligence reform is this Manichaean debate of good versus evil, it will create an enormous amount of political friction, and it'll be very difficult to do. So,
thank you, Jim.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for thinking of the future, not just the present.
Yes. Okay. When I was trying to decide how to contribute to this very eminent panel, I thought that I might talk about four key trends that are occurring and actually shifting the framework of intelligence as I see it. And you may not agree with some of these ideas, so I'm throwing them out partly to start a conversation. But the first of the four key trends that I see is that there is a greater emphasis upon open source intelligence versus classified intelligence compared to before 1990. Open source intelligence has been gaining importance since that time, especially compared, you know, to the emphasis that we placed upon intelligence during the Cold War, where there was a great deal of protection of information. It's partly a result of the growth in social media, but also it's the death of privacy and the explosion of access to information publicly. The federal government has less and less proprietary knowledge, so real secrets are now confined much more to operational matters and technical developments and sometimes opinions by sensitive people. And yet, even at the same time as open source intelligence is more important, far more information is classified and overclassified than ever before. So it's a paradox. We have something where the information that is freely accessible to the public is classified. Things like the WikiLeaks documents, videos of attacks on US soldiers, US drone strikes in Pakistan. There are lots of, and Yemen, and there are lots of examples where the public is quite aware of what is happening, and yet those who have a security clearance are unable to talk about it, and sometimes they actually have less knowledge because they're not able to look at the documents that the ordinarily Joe, the ordinary guy out there on the street has already read. So that's the first trend that I think is somewhat unusual. Secondly, the explosion of intelligence assets in the United States, particularly since 9/11. In response to 9/11, there are lots of statistics that came out in the Washington Post and other places. Some 263 US government organizations were created or reorganized. There are some 1,291 government organizations, 1,931 private companies that all work on problems and programs related to counterterrorism, homeland security, and intelligence. In about 10,000 locations across the United States, more than two-thirds of that capacity rests with the Department of Defense. Intelligence analysts produce about 50,000 reports every year in this country. And so there's this daily tsunami of information, and senior officials rely more than ever upon humans to sift through that information, to distill it, and then to regurgitate what they need to know. So policymakers then try to shortcut the bureaucracy by hiring privateers. For example, former CIA operative Duane Claridge, who had ran a private network of spies in Pakistan and Afghanistan for years until he was investigated, and the contract was terminated in 2011. So in a strange way, we have this explosion of assets, and yet more information does not necessarily make you smarter. And people are trying to work around this massive, unwieldy bureaucracy that we have. The United States, in my opinion, I study terrorism a lot, has gone from having too little understanding of Al-Qaeda and too few knowledgeable analysts and assets to producing overwhelming amounts of data where key nuggets get lost in the noise. Third key trend, new technological means. Tim referred to this, I think I completely agree with him. But those new technological means have both expanded their role and revealed their great limitations. Despite the heavy emphasis on things like satellite data, geospatial information, mass collection of cyber information, new sources of SAR reconnaissance, unmanned aerial vehicles and more autonomous vehicles and so on and so forth, human intelligence is as important as ever. because the most precise instruments are useless against the wrong targets. Big data in intelligence gathering is overhyped. There's a huge amount of information that's gathered, but it leads analysts to get lost in the weeds and to confuse correlation of events with causation of events. And then meanwhile, savvy terrorists or criminals or targets of intelligence need only unplug from the net or stop using a cell phone in order to avoid detection because our human assets are in many cases degrading. Fourth and finally, among these trends, I believe that the roles of the private and public sectors are shifting in important ways with respect to intelligence. The private sector is much more important than used to be the case. In cyber espionage and cyber defense, for example, the federal government plays more of a support role to private industry than the other way around. The US Air Force may be responsible for cyber command, but in nearly every serious incident of cyber conflict that has occurred thus far, the first responders have been the private sector, not the government. The government has played almost a supportive role, while the private sector has been the first to respond. So ironically, as intelligence activity shifts more and more to relying upon information assets and large number of federal government organizations, it's less and less operating on federal government terrain.
Thank you. Thank you. Turning to our only practitioner on this panel, I try a question again. Can non-practitioners of the trade ever really understand the nature of intelligence work?
No.
Thank you. Explain.
Okay, now that I've explained that. Let me go into my prepared remarks.
There you go. Question.
World War II, and especially the subsequent Cold War, woke America up to the importance of continuous institutionalized intelligence collection. Initially, we followed the example of most other nations and focused on human, recruiting and handling human assets. This wasn't just tradition, but also an acknowledgement of the limitations of technology at the time. While we certainly engaged in photo reconnaissance and intercepted communications, at the time, the only way to get the best information, the secrets you needed for national defense, was to recruit people with access. As the Cold War progressed, the U.S. developed a significant technological advantage over our Soviet bloc adversaries. In the military, this was expressed in weapons that were effective enough to more or less balance the Soviet advantage in sheer numbers. In the world of intelligence collection, this was expressed in machines that gave us an advantage in technical collections, like SIGINT and imagery. In both military capability and intelligence collection, it was only natural that we should lead with our strength. This isn't to say that we abandoned human, far from that. However, focus and resources shifted gradually toward technical collection. This makes sense for a number of reasons. First, it flowed from our advantage in all forms of science and technology. Second, technology derives from fields like mathematics, physics, and engineering. So the product of technical collection, is more or less tangible. You may misinterpret it, but it is what it is. It's objective. Human derives from psychology. The personal relationship that an asset has with his or her handler, their unconscious and conscious motivation and bias, their worldview and their ego. So the product is more subjective and contextual. There are basically two ways to get what we need, that we humans get what we need. Hunting and gathering. And we've been practicing both for millennia. When you hunt, you go out deliberately seeking a specific thing. Whether or not you come back with it depends to a great degree on your skill, training, planning, and luck. When you hunt, you're more likely to find exactly what you were looking for and make a big kill. But you're also more likely to come back empty-handed. When you gather, you simply take as much of what's available and then you sort through it to find what you're looking for. In some cases, you literally do cast a wide net over and over again. You're less likely to find exactly what you're looking for, but you're also less likely to come up empty-handed. Of the two, hunting requires more training and experience for the individual to be successful. Gathering doesn't require as much individual training and experience for the individual to be successful, but it does require a great deal of effort. It's labor-intensive. In the modern era, we've been able to reduce the degree of labor through our invention of machines. Once the machine's in place, it makes gathering the easier the two practices. Technical collection can give you vast amounts of information, more than you can get from any single human asset. However, all actions originate in the minds of individuals. So unless the individual has deliberately placed their thoughts in some medium that is accessible to technical collection, there's simply no way of knowing their plans and intentions, especially their secrets, except through a personal relationship in which the asset is willing to tell you what he or she is thinking. Where we are today is, I think, best summed up by Edward Snowden, of all people. In his most recent interview, he said, quote, "It's no secret that the U.S. tends to get more and better intelligence out of computers nowadays than they do out of people." He's wrong. That's like saying 30 years ago that the U.S. tends to get more and better intelligence out of filing cabinets than it does from people. The computer or the filing cabinet doesn't generate intelligence, it's just where the information is stored. Some small part of which may actually be intelligence. Snowden's statement demonstrates a mindset in which the focus shifts from the human to the technical, where the means take on more importance than the ends. Espionage is, they say, or you said, the second oldest profession, which puts it in questionable company, but attests to the fact that it predates computers and satellites and just about everything we associate with intelligence collection today. It's a uniquely human activity. And while we develop increasingly more complex machines to do it with, we're the ghost in machining. Machines don't keep secrets, people do. Our analytic decisions and the foreign policy consequences that derive from them don't come from machines. They come from something even more complex, unique, individual human minds. Moreover, our means of technical collection are moving out of the hands of governments and into those of private citizens. Recent events would suggest that you, as a private citizen, should probably be more concerned that your angry girlfriend might be recording your conversation rather than the NSA, or that your potentially compromising picture is being taken by a stranger with a cell phone rather than a satellite. Michael Warner makes this point very well in his recent book, The Rise and Fall of Intelligence. Technology advances and becomes ubiquitous at a rate faster than our human ability to fully adapt to it. The brain evolves at a much slower rate, to the point where the human mind is the one part of the entire equation that remains virtually constant. So it might be a time that we dedicate as much attention to the human side of intelligence collection as we do to the technical side, as much to the psychology of espionage as we do to the technology.
Thank you.
Dr. Bishop. Please.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. These people are hard act to follow. Let me try anyway. I think what we're talking about here is that we live in an age of total surveillance. And let me start with a personal story. Not too many years ago, it was before Katrina, actually, I had a student who was a very good student. He was in the Reserve Air Force and didn't show up for a midterm. And then I had an email from him saying, "Sorry, Professor Bishop, I was on assignment this weekend in Colombia." Then I emailed him back and said, "Oh yeah, did you burn some cocoa fields?" And then he came by my office and said, "You know, I shouldn't have sent that email. My superiors saw it too. And you must never talk about that email." I forgot the name of the student, so that's why I'm talking about it. But it reminded me that I live in an age of total surveillance too. My emails are being looked at by other people. So in a sense then, I'm not surprised, and here I echo Tim Naftali and all, historically, if you look at what has happened with the Snowden affair. I think the difference is that we all know the government snooped on some people, some of the time, and now with the technical capability, it is snooping on all of the people, maybe all around the world, most of the time. And let me also just give you a few historical case studies of how the government snooped in the past. Meaning there is a long prehistory to what has been going on lately. You probably didn't know that during World War II, the U.S. government had a secret camp out in Vernon, Mount Vernon, Virginia, called Fort Hunt. And in Fort Hunt, they brought by German, including Austrian POWs, and secretly listened in on their conversations. And historians have found over 100,000 pages of transcripts from these conversations. And I tell you, as a historian, I'm very grateful to the U.S. government that it did it, because this is one of the major new finds on how the Wehrmacht thought during World War II. Because they were talking unobstructed, they didn't know the government was listening in, and therefore we sort of get very raw data how the German army thought during World War II. Another such case study is that U.S. Army intelligence listened in on the KGB during World War II and after, the so-called Venona program. And not too long ago, the U.S. government again released the Venona decrypts, and this is a very important source to historians today about World War II intelligence and potential atomic spying by the Soviets at the time. Third case study. We all know that at least since Eisenhower, probably earlier, the government listened in on telephone conversations. Somebody like Tim Naftali, in fact, has been involved in, I think, publishing the Johnson telephone conversations at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. And again, I must say, I'm grateful for the government to do this, including, of course, the transcripts of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because they're an invaluable source for historians today about very high-level decision-making and thinking. And finally, the case study of Daniel N. Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. We know this played a very important role in the latter part of the Vietnam War. Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower, Nixon then went after people like Ellsberg. And I think Ellsberg sort of raises the issue, does a mature democracy need whistleblowers? In the case of Ellsberg, I said, yeah, it's probably a positive thing that his revelation revealed. So these are just a few case studies. You know, the total surveillance state is with us every day. Traffic cameras, the state state governments in Louisiana too, trying to get money from us that way, sort of the secret tax, but they see more than just the traffic violations. The installation of the security cameras in every house, you know, and in the French Quarter where I live now in New Orleans, this is a big deal that private citizens install security cameras, and then when there is crime, they actually give access to the police to study those tapes. So, you know, it's all around us, and the American public doesn't seem to mind. And I think the reaction to Snowden, and historians will study this one day, was very different all over the world. Seeing the indication here already in Nigeria than it is here in the United States. But people don't seem to be particularly exercised about it. So I think the big debate then is about big data. Some people are very excited about it. It's about government secrecy. People like David Frum just recently in the Atlantic Monthly wrote an article about it, arguing that the government needs this in order to protect its citizens. So, you know, we need to talk about the state too. One of my advisors wrote a book on the growth of the state from the 19th to the 20th century called Leviathan 2.0. I think we're living already in a Leviathan 4.0 in terms of the state's power. Anyway, I think I'm going to end it at this and
few okay. thoughts. Thank you. Thank you. Unfortunately, time is flying, and so we can only have a second round responding to comments and maybe disputing them from the panel, and then we'll go to the audience. Tim, you want to be first?
Very quickly. Very quickly. The Ellsberg case is fundamentally different from that of Edward Snowden. Ellsberg withheld four volumes classified volumes regarding the United States negotiations with North Vietnam. He withheld them. He didn't give them to the New York Times because he did not want to affect ongoing U.S. government operations because he wanted to end the war, not complicate the end of the war. He also stood trial. He gave himself up. He didn't fly, run away. The material he gave away, and we can discuss whether or not you should do that, but the material he gave away was historical. It was not about U.S. government operations. It's a very different case, much closer to the whistleblower case. That's the first thing. The second I'd like to mention is the concept of warning has changed. The intelligence business, as I understand it, part of what it does is it provides warning. And the CIA, one of its great objectives throughout the Cold War was to provide warning of an attack. With the change in the nature of the threat, when you went from large organizations that could attack you to small groups of people, that changed the problem of warning. And one of the reasons why the government is I think, seeking more and more information is that it's not as easy as it used to be to follow the elephants. There was a time, and they just declassified some signals intelligence in the Cold War, where we would monitor where the Chinese were moving. We could tell where the Soviet pilots were because they don't encrypt cockpit conversations. We were studying states, and states are big, and when they move, they move with lots of noise. When you're studying individuals, but individuals who could kill thousands, it changes the nature of the target, and that complicates what you're seeking. So warning is changing, or has changed since 9/11, and that's very much a part of the story. The second and final point I wanted to make was about the Ukraine. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States was monitoring all the shipping in the world. You see, one of the things that you do, it's not fun and interesting stuff, but you're looking for changes. And the Soviets never encrypted their shipping manifests. And they started to encrypt them in the summer of 1962. They stopped mentioning what were in their ships. Now, unfortunately, we didn't have a penetration agent in the Kremlin to tell us that the Soviets had decided to put weapons and missiles on those ships and send them to Cuba. So that even though we noticed there was a difference, we didn't know what it meant. In the Ukraine, we saw that the Russians put troops along the border with the Ukraine. Now, I hope we have a penetration agent who could tell us what Putin is thinking, but I suspect we don't. And so all we knew was that they were doing something different, but we didn't know their intention. That remains the biggest challenge in the intelligence community, no matter how much data you have. And it's very rare that you can get inside the head of a policymaker and know what decision he's going to make before he tells his own military.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to comment on one of Audrey's observations. I think broad brush, I think, is absolutely right that the shift in the intelligence profession in the future is going to be going to analyzing open source information that's publicly available. Which would be a much bigger part of intelligence than opposed to traditional things of finding secrets. And I think there's some long-term implications of that, some predictions, and very quickly. So one of them is the advantage is going to go to, and the focus is going to go to, not from stealing secrets, but to looking at vast amount of information, analyzing it faster than anybody else, and figure out what to do with it. The second thing is what government is going to do for you, I think, is going to shift. And the nature of privacy will go from government's job is help to protect your information, which will become virtually impossible, to government's job is going to help prevent the malicious use of your information, which I think is a very different one. And the third thing is that I think the way the governments are going to try to keep secrets in this world is they're going to have a lot less secrets. They're just going to recognize, they're just going to throw it all out there, and they're going to have a lot less secrets and give a lot less people access to those secrets. So that's the way I think the system will evolve over time in response to this overwhelming tsunami of public information.
Thank you.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Following up on that point. I actually think that we have a lot to fear from the private sector with respect to information. Not commenting on the degree to which the public sector is using or abusing its power, I think, as a victim of identity theft myself, I've had far more difficulty trying to fix that problem and protect myself from it and prevent the people who stole my identity from using it in malicious ways against me in the future than I've ever had to worry about whether my email might be misused or whether the NSA might be collecting something about the metadata of the people that I write to who are not in the United States. So again, I think we're greatly underestimating the degree to which the private sector is collecting information upon us that is completely unprotected and a tremendous source of power that was not available to the private sector in the past, and that gives me pause. And second point, quickly, is that I believe that one of the reasons why we have such a tremendous emphasis upon intelligence, particularly in the field that I spend a lot of time studying, which is counterterrorism, is that the American public is completely intolerant of risk of any kind. Terrorism is a natural part of our society, a natural part of human existence. And in the United States, since we started to collect information on terrorist attacks in the United States, starting in the 1970s, there were about 400 attacks. I may have the figure slightly off, but there were hundreds of attacks. In the 1980s, it was at somewhere in the range of 50 in that decade. In the 1990s, it was more like 200. And since September 11th, that is from September 12th to the present time, in our country, we've had a total of, depending on how you count and who you count, 17 to 20. And yet that's still considered to be intolerant. And I'm not saying that there can't be another major attack, but the problem is that Americans are requiring such absolute safety and prevention of any kind of risk that this is what you get.
So have we won the war on terror?
No, I don't think it's possible to win that kind of war, but I do think that we need to bring to a close the reaction to September 11th and to recognize that terrorism is a problem that has to be managed.
John, would you like to answer my question?
Yes, I would. I had time to think about it. Can the layperson understand intelligence the way the intelligence professional does? Pardon the analogy. My wife's gynecologist has studied child labor for years and years and has an incredible understanding of it. My wife has an understanding of it in a different way than he does. Neither one is necessarily better. My wife's experience of child labor is a natural and physical experience. She experienced what she's going through. Her gynecologist, well, he studied it a whole lot, but he's a man and he's never actually done it. He knows a lot more about it, but he's never experienced it. So, I don't want to disparage, I want to say that, oh, intelligence is this kind of thing that no lay person can understand. You can. You can understand it, certainly. You can study it, you can understand it, you can go through the nuances of it, you can go into great detail. But the experience of the collector is completely different. Just the same way the experience of the private on the battlefield is different from the experience of the general.
Okay, thank you. Good.
I have a little to add. Thank you, Tim, for that correction. I think Audrey made the statement about the death of privacy. And I think that's an important subject to consider in this entire matter. And I think it's something that Snowden has thought a lot about too. I mean, if you've heard his interview the other day with Brian Williams, there's almost a missionary kind of quality about him. And part of that missionary quality, I think he is sort of a guy who believes in basic American values and goes back to the founding fathers and thinks there is a Fourth Amendment and the government shouldn't do warrantless searches, at least in the most recent book on him. That's a big theme in there. So I don't know his motivations, but that theme, the death of privacy and what that means for all of us, I think is something that we ought to consider.
Okay. Thank you very much.